Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Girl, real talk. This whole it's new year, time to reinvent myself trash is not the vibe for 2024. You can find someone who loves you for you, as you are. You don't need to read a stack of self-help books, only eat sad salads, or like start meditating at 5 a.m. to be ready for dating. So, yeah, my advice is to download Bumble and find someone who embraces you the way you are right now. Let me know how it goes.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Big box retailers, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a bill in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. Senate Bill 1838 would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, visit handsoffmyrewards.com and tell them to oppose credit card routing legislation paid for by the Electronic Payments Coalition.
When you realize nobody else cares and you're doing it for yourself, you can listen to yourself and you can like let those obstructions go away.
I'm Jordan Kissner, author of the essay collection Thin Places, and this is Thresholds, a weekly series of conversations with writers and artists about moments of epiphany or transformation that changed their lives and their work. A moment that they stepped across, like a threshold, into something new, and the way that experience changed everything they wrote afterward. You probably know Sam Lipsight as a much-celebrated writer of novels and story collections like The Fun Parts, The Ask, Hark. He is also the former frontman of a small but influential noise punk band called Dung Beetle. James Murphy of LCD Sound System was their sound guy in the 80s. Sam wore capes on stage and went by the name Sam Shit. He drew from that era in his life to write his latest novel, No One Left to Come Looking for You, which came out in December. No One Left to Come Looking for You is about a young bass player in a band called The Shits. His name is Jonathan Liptak, but he insists that everyone calls him Jack, Jack Shit. It's the 90s in the downtown punk scene, and Jack's bandmate, The Banished Earl, has stolen his bass, probably to sell for drug money, and then gone missing. The Banished Earl is our frontman, our lyricist, and lead screamer, Jack writes. His brief includes but is not restricted to howls, whimpers, banshee shrieks, declamations, provocations, semi-ironic rooster struts, blind dives into the mosh pit, simulated or else revocable genital self-mutilation, and of course, spectacle. Spectacle above all else. Taking refuge in spectacle, and conversely, taking refuge in the idea that no one is ever really paying attention to the art you make, is what Sam and I wound up talking about for today's episode. The time he spent away from serious writing, capital S, capital W, in his 20s, the time he spent screaming lyrics no one could really make out, taught him something about freedom from expectation that he's carried into his career as a serious, capital S, and very funny writer. Here's Sam Lipsight.
I always wrote as a kid, as a teenager, and I got very serious about it. You know, in college, I was taking workshops, and I really thought that I would, you know, wanted to make a go of it as a fiction writer. In college, I sort of had that feeling. But I also sort of, I took a lot of writing workshops and read a lot of contemporary fiction and wrote stories. And sort of created this identity for myself, a sort of public identity, I would say, among my friends and family as a writer or aspiring writer. And I started to feel like expectation from people around me about, you know, how and whether that was going to be fulfilled.
What did you think the expectations were? I'm just curious what your notion of the shape of the expectation was at the time.
Well, it was like, well, what are you going to do next on your, you know, to fulfill your aspiration? What are your plans? What's your game plan? What's your, you know, how are you going to further your career path, that sort of thing. And so suddenly what excited me about writing was being burdened with this other stuff. And then, you know, it was also being burdened with my own expectations. And also I come from a family of journalists and writers. And so it wasn't all foreign to me. I knew a lot about the business. And one of the reasons I kind of, instead of, you know, applying to an MFA program after college, I, you know, got a cheap apartment in Providence and then later a cheap apartment on the Lower East Side and played in a scuzzy rock band, was to avoid all of that shit. And one of the great things about, I've talked about this before, but one of the great things about being in this band, Dung Beetle, was the music was so fucking loud, nobody could hear my lyrics. And I was screaming them unintelligibly anyway. And that was very liberating for me. And I loved it. And I also had this feeling of like, you know, just do what you want to do and make these crazy sounds that you want to make, because nobody fucking cares anyway. And that was how I, you know, I think that in this band, whatever we were, we kind of got to strange, interesting places live, and kind of, it was exciting. And it was exciting in a way that like a lot of the writing stuff had lost its magic for me. After the band was over and that life for me was over, and, you know, I was suddenly found myself living back home with my mother, who was dying. And I was taking care of her and working these kind of various jobs as a substitute teacher and other stuff. I suddenly realized that I could come back to writing the way I had come to that experience being in this band, Dung Beetle, which was to really understand that nobody really cared and that I could just do what I wanted to do. And that even the people who loved me, my friends, my family, and there weren't that many people, but the few people that loved me, they wanted me to be, you know, happy, whatever that means. They wanted me to have health insurance, if that was possible. They wanted me to, you know, be able to support myself. But they were not waking up in the morning worried about my relationship to the short story. They were not waking up in the morning thinking about, you know, how I was going to negotiate my feelings around realism and postmodernism and create something that I could, you know, stand behind aesthetically. They were not going to worry about how, you know, I was going to navigate questions of, you know, of art versus commerce as it relates to contemporary prose fiction. So all of these things that I thought were, at least, you know, about all of these expectations outside of me, just I realized didn't fucking exist. And I could have the same freedom that I had had in that band, and I could have it by myself in this room, and whatever happened, happened. And that was, I think, a big threshold for me. So there was a relationship between how I approached music and how I came to approach writing. And then around that time, another big threshold was sort of, you know, understanding that and realizing it was just for me, and that whatever I did was going to be just for me. And if other people liked it, that was great. And I wanted other people to to get pleasure and excitement and enjoyment and interesting emotional and intellectual experiences from my work. But in the end, I realized that, like, if I didn't do it, the world was still going to turn. And so nobody, again, you know, nobody cares. So just do what you want to do.
How old were you when the music part of your professional life ended, when you went home to live with your mom?
I would never call the musical part of my life professional. That's for sure.
Okay. The music part of your creative life, when your music era ended, how old were you?
When was the day the music died?
When did that happen?
I guess it was around 20, just about to be 25, maybe 25.
The reason I'm asking is because I think there's something familiar about what you're describing, which is that for sometimes when very, you know, promising young people, in quotation marks, come out of college, there's like actually those first years out of college feel like the scariest, most existentially burdened years, because you have now the work of becoming extraordinary as you have always imagined that you would be. And that process of coming to realize that it's okay also just that actually adulthood and working life and creative life included is just...
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Big box retailers, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a bill in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. Senate Bill 1838 would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, visit handsoffmyrewards.com and tell them to oppose credit card routing legislation paid for by the Electronic Payments Coalition.
Making stuff that actually nobody is necessarily waiting around for you to be extraordinary, and that you likely won't be extraordinary. Seems like an early 20s, like an early 20s existential crisis for sure.
I mean, in some ways, I think you're lucky if you have it. I didn't once meet a therapist who specialized in those people in their early to mid 20s who have jumped through all these hoops and then have no idea, you know, who they are and what they are, and have, you know, existential collapse. I wasn't like that. I kind of knew what I wanted or who I was, or on some level, I didn't really know who I was. Nobody does, but I knew kind of what I wanted to do at that point. But I think you're describing it quite well, and I think it is common. I think this, for me, it was how it related to the making art specifically. In some ways, it later would go on to influence my writing. But at the time, it felt diametrically opposed, because it was in some ways, the opposite of craft. Because at least when we started, nobody could really play their instrument that well. And I never really played it. I was just a kind of screamer. And I learned enough guitar to write some songs, but I never felt even competent enough to play a guitar on stage. And so it was, you know, it was all about kind of, it was, the music itself was very raw and loud and expressive. And then there were a lot of like kind of arty ideas wrapped around it, because we were kind of, you know, basically art punks. And so it did feel diametrically opposed at the time to what I was seeing as, you know, a kind of a more staid, craft oriented MFA approach to making art in my mind. And late, in retrospect, I realized that I was full of stereotypes about all of those things. But that's what it felt like at the time. And maybe it also felt, though, more in line with certain more kind of avant-garde writing traditions that I'd been excited about in college. You know, when I was in high school, I was, you know, so when I'm in high school, I read like every copy of The New Yorker ever. and only the fiction. And kind of make myself into like a kind of high school achiever or something. And win a lot of awards. I become a presidential scholar in the arts, you know. I'm like, it's, and I feel like I've mastered this form, or I'm like really good for a high school writer. And to the point that like, I think I mentioned this once in an interview, but like to the point that some of my stuff got to like a major agent, and I got in touch, you know, while I was like a freshman in college, he called my dorm and was like, I want to, you know, let's get this going. I want to see more stuff. And I knew what I was writing was kind of in this mode that was, you know, looked like what the big short story collections of the time looked like and had the tone, and I kind of had mastered this thing, but it didn't really feel organic to me. It just felt like I had learned this trick. And so then in college, I think that I, you know, got very much into more postmodern stuff, more deconstruction stuff, took a lot of semiotics classes, read a lot of more avant-garde fiction, and wrote this like crazy experimental novel for my senior thesis. And sent it to the agent sort of as like, yeah, here, you want my stuff? Here's my stuff. Which was like completely different than what, you know, he had seen before. And they were like, no thanks. And it was kind of my, you know, it was I felt it as a sort of like, well, you know, I'm doing the real thing now, but it also felt like, you know, I had to now plunge into the opposite direction from whatever it was that had gained me that bit of approbation in the beginning. And so that flung me into this other stuff. And I think that like, but basically there was like narcissism in all of it. It was like, I know this is getting a little convoluted, but I'm trying to make it clear that there was this kind of narcissism in, you know, people care about what I'm going to write. People are looking to me. I need to, you know, take the next step. I need to fulfill my promise. You know, am I going to be a realist? Am I going to be a, you know, an experimentalist? And this is all this shit swirling in my head. And the realization that nobody cares was the thing that finally freed me of that, this kind of ridiculous self-involved swirl.
Yeah, that what I was going to like point out is that I'm sort of hearing that there was like the phase of your younger writing life that was like, I am going to be great by traditional means, by making myself like the 17-year-old achiever. And then immediately, subsequently, the, oh no, now I need to make myself great. I need to be unique, right?
Or like I'm going to be Burroughs or whatever it was. Yeah. So either way, it was a trap. In the end, I ended up doing something that had nothing to do with like these literary traditions. I was doing this very weird shit on stage that was more kind of just performance art. And was more about me kind of crying and writhing around and going out into the audience and trying to, you know, gently stroke the cheek of the toughest looking homophobe in the audience, that sort of thing. It got beyond these other kinds of gestures or these other kinds of, you know, thoughts about what I was doing as a writer. Because it was no longer about that, really. And so that helped work it out of my system. And the way I think, and then when it was over, what I discovered was, now when I'm alone in a room again, I realize that I actually get a lot of joy writing sentences and being in language and using these sentences to propel narratives. And I actually just want to be doing that. The way the scene ended was, you know, the usual ways with people, you know, resentment, fights, drugs, dissolution, loss of faith, you know, the way many things end.
Yeah. That feels like the real full circle moment of coming back and realizing like, oh, I just like to write a sentence, you know, like
well, that was it
started that was from it. There and then it got super complicated and then came back to that same place.
That's exactly how I would think about, or how I do think about it. I got back to the joy I had when I was a little kid, just, you know, writing stories. And that was the like, oh, nobody cares whether I'm doing this or not. And I'm just going to do this. That's my point. It's sort of, I'm doing this for me because I enjoy it. And because that's where those are the moments where, you know, time and anxiety fall away and I'm playing. And that's everything.
Yeah. I mean, how is it easy for you to keep that kind of purity of intention, also as a person who you didn't go on to just, you know, like go on and be an insurance claims adjuster who like purely writes for pleasure. You write, you know, also for
I should have
your job.
I should have.
Do you mean that?
Sometimes, yeah.
Because that's, you know, that's the mantra, like nobody cares is a good and useful mantra, though I imagine some people would maybe find it depressing, but I'm with you in finding that like that must feel really freeing. But also when you go on to make a career out of that same craft, like it isn't actually technically true that nobody cares. How do you like, what are the mental gymnastics around that?
I don't know if it's mental gymnastics. I think that I accept that now I've written 7 books and that there are some people who are interested, who, you know, like to read my stuff and are interested in seeing what I do next, but even they're not waking up worried about whether I'm going to write another book or not either. And so it's kind of the same. And there is an aspect to it where I will say to and I think this helps, stop thinking about your career. Don't think about a career. Just think about the next sentence and this book. And this could be the last thing you write. This sentence, this story, this novel, this could be the last thing. And so you're kind of holding 2 ideas in your head at once. You're trying to create a life where you can have the space and time to make a body of work. But you're also understanding that like every sentence you write might be your last. Yeah, you are trying to have a life where you can create a body of work. What you can't do is, and what I always, you know, make sure that I don't do or steer away from, is start having like big plans about like, well, there's this book and then there's the next book and the book after that. And then there's the other one I'm going to write. And if I'm this great thing I'm not going to use here, I'm going to save that for the other book. And so that kind of planning and forecasting, at least for me, has always been detrimental. Just stay in where you are and understand this could be it. So, you know, don't hoard, just pour everything into it. Don't hoard things for careerist reasons. Like this would work great in this thing I'm writing, but I'm saving it for, you know, the second book in the trilogy.
That brings us to, you know, to this book, which feels so, so tied up in this conversation we're having. No One Left to Come Looking for You. Why was this the book that came up now? Presumably, if it's sort of like, I'm going to devote myself fully to every next thing that presents itself. Why was this the one for right now?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, I think that I always knew I was going to write about this time. And I have in some stories and obliquely in earlier stories, then a little more directly in some other things, but never gave it the full treatment. You know, it's funny, when I was playing in the band, my father, you know, who's not a fan of the music, said, well, at least maybe you'll write about it someday. So, you know, he was right about that. I was, you know, I think that I had just finished, you know, the last book was a book called Hark that I'd published in 2019, and I'd worked 6 or 7 years on that book and taken a lot out of me. And it had been a book, an ambitious book with a lot of different perspectives in it, you know, different characters. And I knew I wanted to write something that was tight and focused and took place over limited amount of time. And I also just really got to, you know, it was the pandemic. I guess it was a little before the pandemic really hit. I guess I started it maybe in the fall of 2019. And I was just sort of, I recently turned 50. I was thinking about the past a lot. I was thinking about, you know, we'd had the 2016 election, and we were kind of, you know, coming towards the next election. And I was thinking about New York back in the early 90s. I was thinking about me back in the early 90s. And I always knew that I would write about this time, but I never really understood how. And then I was thinking about a story. I was thinking about a story I'd written a while ago in which a character steals his roommate's bass to sell for drugs. And I started to think about how I'm always, in the past, I always, you know, made it a sort of badge of honor that I was going to write from the perspective of the unlikable character, you know, the guy who does the wrong thing and the bad thing and still try to make the reader invest emotionally. But then I started to think, well, I was that guy. I mean, I was the guy that took the bass. But I started to feel bad for the, you know, the victim, the one whose bass is stolen, you know, in all aspects of that situation. And so I began to be kind of interested in a character who's, you know, not the guy causing the problem in the band, the guy who's trying to hold it all together. The earnest guy who really believes, as we all did, in this project. You know, some of the content was soaked with irony, but the truly ironic thing was how earnest and passionate we were about doing this band and making this art and having these shows. At any rate, I became interested in that character, and I remember I was just trying to find, I couldn't find a, you know, we were talking before we started recording about finding a room of one's own. I really was having trouble finding a space to write at that point. And I remember I had this notebook and these weird little cheap fountain pens I'd found online. And I took some of them out to this park, like at, you know, on the Hudson River around 137th Street. There were these picnic benches, and I would just sit there and write in this notebook. And I just started writing these sentences about, you know, I had the idea that the guy would be called Jack Shit and that his roommate would steal his bass. And that's all I knew. And so I just started with that first sentence. The day after I decide I'm Jack Shit, the banished Earl steals my Fender Jazz bass. And then I just went from there. And the thing kind of unfurled in these notebooks. And that's how it started.
You said something a minute ago that really feels like it encapsulated what made this book so funny to me as I was reading it, which is the juxtaposition of how so much of the ethos of the music that's being made in the Shits and in their scene is about everything kind of meaning nothing or being fucked up or there being no stakes, and also the stakes being so incredibly high and aesthetic and political purity being of utmost importance. There's this like, everything means everything and everything means nothing. Desperation in these characters that makes them do and say incredibly sincere, incredibly absurd things.
Yeah.
Well, and sometimes that's really dangerous things.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I think that's what I wanted to capture. In my band, there was a meltdown that almost destroyed the whole band because one night at a show, one of us broke character to ask the audience if they'd seen this bag that had some of our equipment in it. You know, and that seems like, who cares, right? But to us, that was the end of the world. That was catastrophe because, you know, I mean, there's a whole bit in the book about, you know, the importance of the fourth wall. And this sort of laid back, easygoing, reaching out into the audience, pretending like we're all, you know, in this room together was anathema to us. So, yes, these characters, and I guess we did. And, you know, on a certain level, I still do care to an absurd level about ridiculous things. But sometimes that's, I think, how you can get yourself to do what you need to do.
Well, right. I mean, I'm thinking about the fact that most of the what you would say maybe is like the most elevated experiences of theater that you've ever seen, like, really rely on everyone buying into a set of assumptions that are quite ridiculous, which is that we're all going to agree that, you know, like that is kind of the ground level buy-in required for most art, for most great art to happen too.
Right.
What? Sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, I'm, yes. And I think that like there was the radical, I guess what I'm also getting at is the radical gesture of breaking the fourth wall became so commonplace that to these characters, it was about finding that magic again, that you're talking about, that suspension of disbelief, that buy-in, and creating that barrier again so that the artistic moment can occur. It's in the worrying about the stuff that most people would tell you not to worry about it, on the level of syntax, on the level of diction, on the it's that. It's a kind of, I guess it's a sort of constant revising. It's the fiddling, the anxiety that, you know, one could have found a better sonic relation in a sentence. It's seeing all the, like, you know, reading something you've written and published and seeing all the missed opportunities, you know, and striving ever more. And, you know, at a certain point, the things that you, you know, hear or don't hear or, you know, only come from having read the sentence 100 times, and nobody else is going to do that.
Right. It's the caring too much, or too much, except it's exactly how much you have to care. Nobody else has to care that much, but you do.
Right. And everyone, you know, everyone will say, hey, perfection's the enemy of good or whatever that is. As you're like trying, you know, as you're killing yourself. But you know, there's the part of you that says, fuck that. And yeah, you care too much, and you have to. And then in the end, you know, my favorite line is about all this is that Charon line about, you know, you never finish anything, you just turn away in disgust. And I think that's the disgust is the realization that like it's never gonna be good enough, no matter how much you try. But you still have to try. And you know, that's something that I talk about when I teach. It's sort of like a short story. You should be able to manage every word. Like, you should actually, like, by the end of writing a short story, at least for the, you know, for a little while, for a few moments, you should actually kind of know where every word is in that story. You can't do that in a novel or a book. You can't manage every word in a book, but you should try. And in the trying, you'll get somewhere you'll get pretty far. And so I think, and then again, like the absurdities that you're talking about, some of it is just that tyranny of small differences. It's, you know, I look back now and say, why did I hate that band so much? They were fine, you know, but at the time, and it was funny, I was emailing with someone who had about this book. He liked the book far more, you know. This was a guy who actually was a major figure in music. But he was saying how it was Dean Wareham from Galaxy 500 mm-hmm. and Luna. But he was saying, you know, he remembered back in the day when you were in a band, it was like being in a little gang. And you just like, no matter what the objective, that's not what he said, but this is my reading of it. What your objective sense of what the music of other people was, like, you know, you had to sort of hate those other gangs on some level. So, you know, there was this tyranny of small differences because this band like plays it this way, or this band, you know, is a little too poppy, or this band's trying to, you know, do this. And that's, you know, aesthetically wrong. And it's hilarious that you care about that stuff, but it's also important that you care about that stuff. And I guess that's what the book's about.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways it sounds like the philosophical journey you're describing is going from one kind of caring too much about one category of thing that you deem to be fundamentally, ultimately unuseful, to making peace with caring too much in a different way, or like about process rather than about, I don't know, audience or expectation.
From caring too much about not only audience expectation, but about anything else, about how your work compares to other work, about what else is, about the state of the art, about what, you know, where you stand in relation to, you know, other people doing similar things, all of that stuff. Not just the expectation about your career, but just about like, you know, where you stand in the field, and not caring about any of that, but being incredibly attuned and attentive to the point of madness about your own work. I guess that's the shift.
Does it feel like, is that what it felt like writing this book?
Well, this is the other irony, is like, you know, if you really are like that a lot of the time, you do get moments of flow where we're making it sound like it's, you know, you're pulling your hair out all the time and gnashing your teeth. And it's not like that at all. If you're really practiced at this and you're doing it for real, you get flow, and it happens, and then you can revise and you can change and you can manipulate and so forth. But you're just inside your song.
I have to say, I was imagining that there was going to be plenty of gnashing of teeth in general in all creative processes that have such good output as yours, but I'm happy to hear it's more flow than gnashing.
Well, there's plenty of gnashing, but I think that like you do the gnashing so you can get to the flow. Let's put it that way. But I, you know, it's not fair because the stuff, you know, unlike maybe other situations, you know, the more you gnash your teeth, the harder you work. That doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get your best sentence. But I think that agitation is to get yourself into the place where you can relax, because that's really, and if you can do that without gnashing your teeth, all the more power to you. But I think that if you're truly within what you're doing, it doesn't have to be all angst. It's just focus. It's attention. It's staying with your object. It's not evading. It's and then playing. And so then you're kind of, you know, you're listening to yourself, and that's really what it is. And that's once you really, and again, to like circle back once more, like when you realize nobody else cares and you're doing it for yourself, you can listen to yourself and you can like let those obstructions go away and sort of let the utterance come through. And then you can put on later, after you get those early drafts, you can put on your, you know, your critical hat, and that's when you can do more gnashing and anxious editing and changing things around. But you have to like also respect what happened initially.
Thresholds is produced by Drew Broussard. Music and editing by Laura Faye Oshenwood of Arthur Moon. Our art is by Lorelei Grossman. Special thanks to Justin Alvarez and our hosts at LitHub Radio. You can find out more about our show, listen to past episodes, and get in touch at our website. ThisIsThresholds.com. If you're listening to this on a podcast platform and you haven't already subscribed, please subscribe. Or you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, wherever you normally listen, and subscribe and review us there. Thanks. We'll see you next week.